Hello everyone and welcome once again to Motos and Friends. This is the weekly podcast brought to you by the editors at Ultimate Motorcycling Magazine. This week, editors Don Williams and Nick DeSena discuss the new 2024 Aprilia RS 457. This is Aprilia's newest entry into the highly competitive lightweight sport bike class. The smallest RS has it all, including a parallel twin motor, full electronic suite, and an excellent handling chassis. Hey, what's not to like? Nick shares his thoughts on the Aprilia, where he rode it on track in Italy, and he shared the track with Maverick Vinales for the day. Sounds like fun. In the second segment this week, associate editor TJ Adams chats with Mark Foster, founder and expert roaster of the acclaimed Foster-built coffee, based in the Catskill Mountains of New York State. Well, what does that have to do with motorcycles, I hear you ask? Well, Mark is also a passionate motorcycle guy, and in this month of April, he's giving away a custom Royal Enfield 350 motorcycle. Yes, true. Please visit the Foster Built Coffee website for details of how to enter to win. But hurry, you only have a few days left to get your entry in. So, from all of us here at Ultimate Motorcycling, we hope you enjoy this episode.
We flew out to Modena, Italy, which some listeners might know of as the birthplace of Ferrari. There's two museums. There's the museum that pertained to his house, and then there's another factory sort of museum that's not too far away.
So you tested the Aprilia RS 457 on its home turf of Italy.
Yes, in Italy, but more specifically at Autodromo di Modena. How an American would say it is Autodromo di Modena. So basically just a fairly tight racetrack, you know, by a lot of standards. Some might actually confuse it for a kart track, but it's not that small. It's actually a 1.3-mile circuit. So for West Coast listeners that may be familiar with tracks like Streets of Willow, which is a supporting racetrack at Willow Springs International Raceway. Why it's called international, I couldn't tell you.
Well, they let people from any country ride and drive there.
Yeah, that's definitely it. Probably the most world-class thing about Willow Springs is the toilets. But yeah, but it's here nor there. Streets of Willow is actually awesome. I would say it's a little bit bigger than Streets of Willow, just in terms of width and then also the conditions, and also the facility is kind of what you'd expect from a European racetrack. I mean, they have full-fledged garages and you can actually touch the paint because there's grip. And that said, it's an extremely technical racetrack. If listeners were to go ahead and just dig up a map of it, it's a very tight, twisty, extremely engaging little racetrack. So kind of perfect for a little bike like the Aprilia RS 457, which doesn't pull any punches with its name. It uses a 457cc parallel twin engine to power the thing. This is what we would sort of see as the first entry-level sport bike from Aprilia in the United States in quite a few years. You know, there have been, you know, RS250s and things like that that date back to the early 2000s and even prior to that. But realistically, you know, up until the RS660, Aprilia didn't have a middleweight or an entry level sport bike within their ranks, within the US market specifically. Europe and other markets see some of the lightweight and lower displacement Aprilias that the brand has made for years and years and years, but we just never got them.
Right, but this is a street legal bike, not like the old RS250.
Yeah,
two strokes.
Exactly, like the old RS250 two strokes, there was a street legal version, but then there's a race version too, and that's usually what Americans are familiar with. So
right
now we actually have a full-fledged ladder for you know, the Aprilia sport bike segment that starts with the Aprilia RS 457, then goes to the RS660, then goes to the RSV4 superbike. So, you know, they have every rung in the sport bike ladder now, but we're here to talk about the first step in that ladder.
Okay. What do we need to know about the RS 457?
a lot of things, I guess. But
okay.
I don't know. Let's start with the engine. Okay, so
well, hop on the bike. It's smaller engine. How small is the bike itself?
You know, it's pretty par for the course in terms of size and dimensions and things like that. I would not say it's a Lilliputian motorcycle, but yeah, if you were to compare it to an RC 390, a Kawasaki Ninja 400, or now 500, Yamaha YZF-R3, it's pretty on par with that. Has a wheelbase that's a little bit longer for the class. I would say the cockpit feels a bit more spacious than most of the class. It's still fairly tight when you're measuring it front to back. So, you know, you can really throw your elbows out and get pretty sporty with it because they've designed the fuel tank to basically have a cutout towards the front of it. So you can actually tuck in behind the bubble, which isn't something you can really say of the Ninja 400 and 500 platforms. It has a more mature riding position than some of the other bikes in the class. It's not as street oriented, we'll say, but Aprilia did something pretty keen in the sense that during the presentation, they cited that they wanted to achieve a riding position that was right between the orange bike and the green bike. And by that, they mean the RC 390 and at the time, the Ninja 400. So it's not as aggressive as the RC 390 because that pretty much has not a 100% super sport riding position, but not too far off.
Right. When we talk about the Ninja 400, we're talking about the standard one, not the RR.
Correct. So the Ninja 400, not the ZX4RR. So yeah. So the parallel twin bike, not the inline four bike.
Yeah.
In case anyone confused that, you know, although the Kawasaki Ninja 400 is literally called the 400, but because the other one is a 400cc bike.
And a Ninja.
Yeah, just to clarify, we're talking about the entry-level bikes. Anyway, then the Kawasaki Ninja 400 and 500 for that matter, because that bike has just been updated. And the only difference is the engine.
Funnily enough, it's a 451 and the Aprilia is a 457.
Yeah, yeah. So riding position on the Kawasaki has always been a little bit more sit up and beg. And what we mean by that is you're very neutral. It's very accommodating for the street rider. Okay. So it's going to be very comfy in that regard. However, your handlebars are a bit narrow and they're kind of tucked in. So it kind of draws your elbows in a little bit T-Rexy, so to speak. But if you're riding on the street, that's never something you'd really think about until you start having to get your elbows out. And then it doesn't entirely restrict you. The Aprilia strikes that middle ground. But still, look, it's an entry-level bike. It's a smaller motorcycle overall. It's not going to feel as big as a middleweight or a superbike for that matter. But again, it's not super cramped. So I'm at 5'10" tall, 32-inch inseam. I think it's pretty comfy. You know, you can get very sporty on it considering we only did a track day. We didn't do any street riding. So as much as it was a comfortable motorcycle, and I could see this working really well for road riding, just general everyday life, nothing was slowing me down on the racetrack either. I mean, there's plenty of ground clearance. It wasn't too often that I was scraping toe sliders or, you know, peg sliders, things like that. So despite the fact that, you know, we're on the track and that's where we pushed it, it's a pretty well-rounded motorcycle in that regard. So yeah, comfort-wise, they did a good job. And I could see it being very livable in the real world outside of the racetrack.
Cool. Okay, so we have a bike that's not completely sport-oriented, but certainly not completely street-oriented. So they have kind of a nice mix there.
Yeah, the thing is super, super narrow as well. I should mention that. That's something that you're going to see a lot of in the entry-level class because we're talking about low displacement parallel twin engines or single-cylinder engines in the case of the KTM. But the seat height, if we pull up our handy-dandy spec sheet, is only 31.5 inches. Then you couple that fact with the, you know, the reality that it is a very thin motorcycle between the knees. And, you know, like I said, 5'10" tall, 32-inch inseam. I was able to plant my boots on the deck with room to spare. So that means shorter riders are going to have the ability to ride this thing without, you know, without it being too tall or cumbersome. And, you know, especially when you're first starting your motorcycling career, you're a little bit kind of wobbly off your starts and stops and things like that. So being able to plant your boots on the deck is super important. And that's something that pretty much every bike in this class can accommodate pretty well. And this one does not, it doesn't exclude itself from that conversation.
Okay. So we've kind of set the table as far as how the ergonomics are set, not super sport-like, but also not pure street-like. So with that in mind, how does the engine perform?
So the engine is something that, you know, we had no bearing for, right? Because like we mentioned before, this is the first entry-level Aprilia that we've received in the United States. So there's no history that we can lean on. All we can lean on is the fact that Aprilia has generally made some really awesome engines, you know, the RSV4, the RS660, et cetera, et cetera. And by and large, the Italian brand does a good engine. I'll break out some horrendous Italian, molto bene engine. And they really take a lot from the RS660 in terms of influence, but it is a clean sheet design. So it's not something, it's not a sleeve down 660, for example. That would just be a bit ridiculous, honestly, and probably just weigh entirely too much. So, you know, it is a 457 cc displacement engine, features a 270-degree crank, which is the same thing that's found in the RS660 and a lot of other parallel twins these days. It's kind of become the in vogue firing order, mainly because it delivers an exciting characteristic, has an awesome exhaust note to it, but the power delivery is pretty sweet. So with that, you get something that is pretty torquey off the bottom, offers good mid-range power, and still pulls all the way through. And it has a fairly high red line of 10,700 RPM, that's getting up there. And that's stock, right? So if you were to do something aftermarket, maybe take this thing racing or throw a, you know, pipe and a flash on it, ostensibly, you're probably going to get a little bit more out of it. Now, claimed numbers, we're seeing 48 horsepower and 32 foot-pounds of torque. That is towards the pointy end of the class overall, so that does make it one of the most powerful engines in the class. And I don't think it is the most powerful engine in the class, but it's one of them. Regardless of that, it makes they claim that it makes 82% of its peak torque just around 3,000 RPM. So although we rode it at a racetrack, which I'm going to mention 10,000 times today, you know, we're at this really tight, sinewy racetrack. You know, there's some really fun sweeping corners, some fast stuff, but a lot of tight technical stuff. And having that torque on hand allows you to often just carry a gear taller into the corner, be a little bit lazier, which makes the bike pretty forgiving. And if you apply that to someone that's first starting to ride, well, that can go a long way for one, building their confidence. And, you know, if you make a mistake into a corner, say you don't get your shifting right, you're still going to have power to pull you off the apex. So it's not as demanding as some other engines in the class where you really have to keep the revs up and work to get any sort of power and response out of it. Here, this thing just, you know, it's happy to plod along, but it also can just rev out and be a bit of a spicy little firecracker in that regard. So even looking at it from an experienced rider's perspective, I had an absolute blast on this thing. And I think it's probably going to be one of the more competitive engines in the class. There's some other really cool aspects about it that extend down to the lower end. So the transmission, I would say top marks go to that. It's one of the best examples in the class that we have right now in terms of its shifting actuation, the clutch engagement, and just the fact that it, you know, combines all that with a very light clutch pull. Again, newer riders are going to be enjoying that, especially in a street context, because as you know, when you're going down the road, say you're filtering traffic or, you know, just slipping the clutch, doing that sort of thing, it has a very positive engagement. But the clutch pull doesn't require a lot of effort. So you're not going to be wearing your hand out, you know, over time. There's also an accessory up-down quick shifter. It's $399. It's a little bit pricey, we'll say, but it works great, especially when you're kind of on the pipe and, you know, really twisting that ride-by-wire throttle, which is, you know, well-suited. And you do get three different ride modes with it. they don't adjust just peak power. All they adjust is the throttle map. And you get Sport, Eco, and Rain. Because we're on the racetrack, we use Sport predominantly. But I could see myself using Eco if I was just starting out, if I just got my license and I wanted to get familiar with the bike without kind of, you know, scaring myself a little bit. Eco could definitely work. It just takes that edge off, makes that roll on power a little bit softer and more approachable for a new rider.
So you're saying that this bike, despite it being a track bike that they took you to the track to test it, is still suitable for a truly not just a new to the track rider, but a new rider.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, the logic with taking us to the racetrack and just allowing us to flog the thing at the racetrack could be a little bit confusing for a reader or listener, because someone might think, okay, this is a hardcore entry-level street bike. The truth is, it's just a street bike that has performance potential enough for us to go and enjoy a ripping little day at the racetrack and, you know, kind of be none the wiser, if that makes sense.
Right. And because somebody like you, who's a highly experienced rider and very skilled, you would want to be able to find the limits of the bike, and you wouldn't want to do that on the street. It makes more sense to do that on the track.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I agree with the highly experienced and or skilled part, but no, the point stands. It's one of those things where it's a little bit of a flex from Aprilia, because they know they've got something on their hands that is definitely competitive, and they wanted to showcase it in the, you know, in the most high performance environment that you could, which is a racetrack. That said, there's a lot of takeaway that we learned at the racetrack that you could apply to the street. Like I mentioned, with the good low end torque, that's going to be enjoyed by riders regardless of skill level. So despite the fact that this thing has a bit of a spicy attitude that you can really extract at a racetrack, how that will play in the real world, I think, is going to be pretty positive overall. So yeah, it's something that I really enjoyed. And I think it's got a lot of character. It's got a brilliant exhaust note because of that 270 degree crank, which is unique to the class overall. No, actually, sorry, that's incorrect. The CF Moto 450 SS has the same 270 degree crank. So that thing has the potential to sound pretty awesome when it's got a pipe on it as well. But if you talk about the Ninja 400, 500, the Yamaha YZF R3, the RC 390, which is a single, so it just kind of sounds a bit farty, you know, a lot of the bikes just don't sound as aggressive as this Aprilia, which really, if we're honest, it just kind of sounds like an RS660. It's kind of loud. It's pretty awesome. Not loud to the point where you're going to piss off your neighbors, but you get the idea.
Right. Unless your neighbors are at the track.
Well, no, they'd probably enjoy it, because if they live next to a racetrack, ostensibly they'd be cool. I mean, their house is around Modena, so it's like those people like it.
Okay. So how does the handling play into the friendly power delivery?
Yeah, so that's something that obviously you want to get right. So you need some parity between the engine and the chassis, because if the engine were too powerful, it would just tie the thing into knots. And this is one of those areas where Aprilia has, to me, Aprilias have always done something very well, whether we're talking about the RS660, the RSV4, multitude of generations of the RSV4, the Tuono, the Malay. I mean, we're going way back here, but to me, Aprilia has always been synonymous with handling. That's like their thing, chassis, good chassis design. And they're kind of pulling out all the stops within this class specifically, because this bike features a twin spar stressed member design. And that's basically ripped out of the same playbook of the RS660. So you have a lightweight aluminum twin spar frame that uses that 457 engine as a stressed member, saving weight. And then it has a steel swing arm, which connects directly to the engine, again, saving weight. But the major benefit to that design is that it significantly stiffens the chassis when you compare it to, you know, traditional steel tubular chassis designs that we'd see permeating this class. So again, that's going to be your RC390, your CF Moto 450 SS, your R3, Ninja 400 to 500, you get the idea. So the fact that we're using something with the Aprilia RS457 that's a lot sturdier right out of the box, just in outright lateral torsional stiffness, makes this bike feel much more mature than, say, some of its competitors. because I raced a Ninja 400 for a few years. And the main thing is when you push those bikes, you know, these budget bikes, quote unquote, the deficiencies become pretty obvious, right? They're meant for compliance. They're meant for bump absorption. But when you start braking aggressively into corners, accelerating, carrying massive corner speed, and then hitting bumps while you're doing so, you can initiate some flex, or just, you know, even if the corner is pretty flat, you're going to do it anyway. But, you know, this is one of those things where, because they brought out higher spec chassis technology that's usually associated with more expensive motorcycles, I would say they're getting ahead of the pack in a lot of ways. The only chassis in this class that I think would really step to it is the RC390s. Because KTM has done a really good job in that regard. But if you were talking the Kawasaki, the Yamaha, there's going to be a lot of flex that you have to upgrade and, you know, fight. But what it does here as a baseline is allow this bike to not only be extremely agile, because it has a fairly, you know, fairly aggressive numbers overall, but it makes it much more planted while on the edge of the tire. And that's something that we couldn't say, you know, stock to stock for some of the other bikes in the class, which normally we wouldn't sit there and rant about comparables. But the fact is, we've all ridden a lot of these bikes quite a lot. I also owned one or raced one.
Okay. So is the bike forgiving? I mean, if it's for beginner, when I hear, you know, that the chassis is stiff, I start thinking that as soon as somebody makes a mistake, they're going to pay. Does that play out that way?
No, not in the way you're saying, but there's still the penalty of this is a lightweight bike. So you're dealing with less horsepower. So if you do happen to, say, come into your set of corners and you don't maintain your roll speed, well, you just don't have the same horsepower that you would on a middleweight or a leader class machine to pick you up off the apex and send you down that straightaway. Still, you have to maintain your corner speed. The advantage here is that you have a chassis that allows you to huck this thing into corners much harder and with much more confidence to really maintain corner speed, which is what lightweight bikes are all about. So in terms of forgiveness, well, I would say you have a much loftier performance ceiling just in terms of handling. So by that logic, you do have more forgiveness baked into this thing. You can correct lines. You can make mistakes. You can kind of do whatever you want and it's going to be okay. And the caveat here is we didn't use the stock tires because we were at a track day. The stock tires are TVS Euro Grip Pro Torque Extreme tires.
Oh, well, we're all very familiar with those because we live in India, right?
Yes. Yes. I'm sure all of our listeners are very familiar with the TVS Euro Grip Pro Torque Extreme tires. And anyway, we used Pirelli Diablo Super Corsa V4 SP tires, which I'm sure most.
So pretty much the same tires is what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much. that does kind of hint at one thing. Aprilia partnered with TVS, which is an Indian manufacturer, with the tire construction because the RS457 is manufactured in India. Some listeners may not be aware of this, but Piaggio actually has manufacturing facilities in India. And that's where the RS457 is built, which is why it can keep its introductory MSRP of $6,799 where it is. Because if this were an Italian-made bike, that'd probably be a bit more expensive. Now, back to the tires. Okay, so we had super courses, we had lots of grip, you know, the power to grip ratio, which is something you don't normally hear people say. We had more grip than we knew what to do with, which is usually a good thing. So yeah, chassis-wise, it's not going to be super stiff and unforgiving, even with the suspension. You know, it has an inverted fork, preload adjustment there. You have a shock featuring preload adjustment, so you don't have any damping adjustment. But that said, it's spring and damped. I would say a bit stiffer than most entry-level bikes. Typically, those are sprung and damped for, you know, super lightweight riders, you know, borderline kids. And this bike has good hold up on the brakes. It maintains lines at the apex. So it's not going to be wallowy. It's not going to be squatting excessively. You know, there is some forgiveness to it. There is some give in the suspension. But again, it's one of those things where Aprilia was like, you know, we can do something with this chassis. We can do a little bit more here. And they gave that to the end user. That said, the racetrack was pretty smooth. So bump absorption, things like that, a little bit tough to suss out unless you're like me and you started aiming at curbs and stuff. So how does it feel on the street? That's an unknown. That said, do I think it'll be too harsh for the road? Probably not. I don't think I would go that far. In my experience anyway, a lot of the lightweight bikes are sprung and damped so light that they almost need a little bit of more spring. They need a little bit more damping. So I think this will be closer to what an American sized audience will want anyway. You know, if you're pushing that 170, 80, 190, 200 pounds, and 200 pounds apparently is getting close to the national average. So yeah, despite it being an Italian bike, Italian design bike, I think it'll fit right in the American market.
One thing you mentioned was squatting on the brakes. How are the brakes and what kind of brakes does it offer?
Okay, so braking components, that is, you know, one area if there is a quote-unquote black spot on the Aprilia RS457's record, it'll be here. The brakes aren't terrible by any means. We're not going to throw them under the proverbial bus. They use Bi-Bree components. A really cool thing here is we're starting to see radial mounted calipers come to the lightweight class. You know, think back to Ninja 250, Ninja 300, bikes like that. You're talking old school axial mounted calipers with a pretty wooden master cylinder and brakes that overall are not the greatest thing on the planet. Bikes like the RC390, the CF Moto, the Aprilia RS457, they're bringing a higher spec to the game. And the Aprilia follows in that same footstep. So we have a single rotor up front. It's a 320, so pretty beefy size rotor for the bike, just single, cool. And it's a Bi-Bree, so it's the sub-brand from Brembo. But again, it's manufactured overseas, and when I say overseas, I mean not in Spain.
Well, Spain's overseas too, yeah. So, I mean, I get the feeling, like how I see how the Bi-Bree brand is kind of positioned, is it seems like it's just for the small bore bikes. We don't see Bi-Brees on inexpensive big bikes. We only see them on small bikes.
Yeah. And usually foreign market stuff, at least what we would perceive as foreign market.
Right.
So lightweight bikes that really aren't going to be as demanding on the brakes as anything else. So anyway, you know, braking feel, there's not a whole lot of feel. There's good braking power overall. We opted for the race pads, which are actually in the official accessory handbook. You can order them point of sale, do that. It does come with steel braided lines, so it does improve engagement, and that's always a good thing. And the reason they didn't use a dual rotor is because, well, it doesn't need it. There's that. But they also tested it with a dual rotor setup and just found that it kind of slowed the handling a little bit, which might seem kind of goofy to talk about because they're like, oh, it's just another rotor, but that adds gyroscopic forces. And
yeah, that's a lot of weight on the front wheel.
Yeah. Especially for a lightweight bike. If we're talking a super bike, it's like, it doesn't matter.
You have to have two, right?
Yeah. Not only do you have to have two, but the bike's going to overpower that anyway. Right. Lightweight bikes don't have that luxury. Right. So, you know, the radial mounted caliper, that's cool. Steel braided brake lines, cool. Master cylinder, I think that's where things kind of fall apart for I shouldn't say fall apart, but that's where things kind of wane a little bit on the performance minded. You know, if we're looking at it from a pure like track day bro performance mindset. Now, if you apply these brakes to the street, to a newer rider, they're not going to have an aggressive bite that could make them tip over in a parking lot. You know what? I've never dropped a bike, but I've done the thing where the thing's falling over and I'm desperately trying to pick it up, which is almost worse.
No, it's worse when it falls.
It depends. But it's one of those things that it's an easy thing to screw up, especially when you're first starting out, because you know you got the bar cranked over, you dab the brake too much, and down she goes. Common thing for new riders to do. Really, you know, the brakes on this thing, they're not going to do it. And on a street context too, if you're just talking about riding this thing on the street, I think they're going to be more than adequate. If you're a more experienced guy, dude, just replace the master cylinder and I think you're going to be in pretty damn good shape.
And use the brake pads that you had. Yeah. In fact, listening to this, it all kind of makes me interested in what the bike is in truly stock condition on the street. Because, you know, you tested something of a ringer.
Well,
you know, when you upgrade tires, you know, we all know how important tires are. You upgrade brakes. That's another big upgrade. You know, you have you have two major systems that are not stock. The engine's the same. The chassis the same. Suspension's the same. But, you know, anybody that watches MotoGP knows about tires.
Do they equalize? Don't know. Probably not. But that said, in a street context, I'm sure the brakes will be fine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wouldn't doubt that. I've just seen exactly what flavor of fine they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, will it be microwavable dinner fine or, you know, fast food fine, taco truck fine? I don't know. There's levels.
Or Michelin star restaurant fine.
Yeah. You know,
probably not that. Because it's not a Michelin star restaurant price, you know. So how does the bike look for, was it say $6,600?
Starting price is $6,799. So it is on the pricier end of the spectrum for the class.
Right. Not nearly as much as the Ninja's 4RR, but considerably more than the Z500 or the Yamaha R3.
Exactly. Yeah. The Kawasaki ZX4RR. That's kind of a different beast because it's an inline four engine. It's technically displacement wise, it's in that class, but it's a whole different animal.
Right.
We're the parallel twins is where we should really be, you know, trying to steer the conversation. That said, it is on the pricey end for this class, but you're getting a lot of stuff that isn't in this class. For example, the twin spar aluminum chassis.
How does the bike look finish-wise and styling?
So styling-wise, if you go to the website, look at the photos. We had the up-spec livery, which will set you back a couple $100. It's inspired by the RSGP MotoGP bikes that Maverick Viñales and Aleix Espargaró are currently riding. And interestingly enough, Maverick Viñales was actually at our track day showing us how we're all terrible.
You didn't stuff him any corners?
No. No,
surprisingly,
I did.
You gotta show him who's boss.
No, there was no opportunity for that. He actually passed me. He passed me very, very gentlemanly. And because I was wearing his signature helmet, he gave me a big thumbs up. He approved of my fanboying. And yeah, that was that. No, he just rode with us and spun laps, followed people, and just basically had a fun day.
Now when you were in the pits, did he wear the Batman mask?
He did not. This is pre-Batman.
Oh, that's kind of disappointing. But oh, I guess you only get what you get.
No, but overall, you know, it looks solid. It's one of those things where, you know, Aprilia has the advantage in the sense that this class has been pretty established. So we kind of know what we're getting out of stuff like the R3, which hasn't been updated in a little bit. The Ninja 500 just got an update, and that took a big step forward in terms of aesthetics and also features. The RC390, that's, you know, when it got updated a while ago, that thing had some really good features with a full color TFT display and things like that. And this is up to snuff with what we're seeing in the class. So you are getting, whether you're talking R3 or 400 or 500 or an RC390 or, you know, CF Moto, you're getting a lot of bike for the money because you do get a full color TFT display on the RS457. Like we mentioned before, ride by wire throttle, different maps, yada, yada, yada. You do have two different ABS modes. We forgot to mention that. And traction control too. All adjustable. So with the ABS modes, you have a street mode, which is front and rear ABS. And then you have essentially a track ABS mode where it's front only. And that's kind of a different thing. So your Ninja 400 to 500, your R3s, they're not going to feature stuff like that. Whereas the RC 390 and the Aprilia, given the two brands, KTM and the and Aprilia, they demonstrate that performance first mentality, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. So I have a question on the 457. Does it have basically the same software package as the 660? And does it have the same like switch gear?
No, different. The switchgear is similar looking, but it's a completely different software package. It's not an IMU based system, so it's not lean angle detecting. And quite frankly, with the bikes of this horsepower, I would say that's probably overkill. You know, the KTM 390 Duke has an IMU and it has less horsepower. It's like, it's a cool feature, but at the same time, do you really need it?
You probably only need it when, you know, something goes wrong. Like there's, you know, a slick spot in the road or something.
On a middleweight, it makes more sense because you're negotiating more power. On a superbike, it absolutely makes sense. Lightweight bikes. Yeah. Anyway, but we have adjustable traction control. And honestly, the TC works pretty great. You know, I ran it in high and low settings. Obviously, it was more intrusive in the higher settings because that makes sense. And in the low settings, yeah, it wasn't a big deal. And actually, as we ran the tires, we actually didn't swap tires. A lot of the times at press trips, they'll keep freshies on as, you know, as often as possible. We had three rotating groups, which by the end of the day meant we did 15 sessions. Like those bikes did 15 sessions, although I think I only did 5 or 6 sessions or something. Yeah, so the rear tires were pretty shagged. And you can expect that because you have three different journalists getting on the bike every 20 minutes, right? And that's a lot of action, a lot of laps for a set of tires to go through, even on a lightweight bike. So they did give or take 15 sessions. And as the rear tire started going, we were one of the last groups out. I think we actually ended the day. And yeah, that TC light started coming in handy, especially on the right side where the tire was really, really beat to hell. But that's the thing. That's actually a good thing to experience because you get to see how the chassis behaves as the tire drops away, you know, as you're losing grip. And the chassis still kept it together. You could still get good feedback and understand what was happening underneath you without being, you know, scared that you're like, okay, yeah, the tire's going, we're losing profile, you know, things of that nature, but it's keeping it together. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of good mechanical grip, you know, in spite of a tire that's wearing out. And honestly, 15 sessions for, you know, three different journalists getting on it every 20 minutes and then three different skill levels too. You got some ripping fast dudes, some kind of middle of the road A guys, A group guys, some slower people. And it's not exactly the greatest thing for a tire to just be bouncing around in terms of its cycles like that, we'll say.
Yeah. How did Maverick's tire look?
Amazing. Perfect. In fact, in fact, that's why he won those COTA races, because of what we showed him at Motorno. We were like, look, if you want to ride terribly, follow us. So,
well, cool. So it sounds like this is going to be a popular track day bike for somebody getting involved in that aspect of the sport.
For sure. I think it's going to be a popular bike in the entry level class. And it brings a level of performance that, you know, say for the RC 390, nothing else is really matching in terms of chassis. But this thing is the whole package. And although we only rode it at the racetrack and got kind of, you know, one side of what this bike can do, trawling around at lower speeds and opening laps. And, you know, when you're trying to like find your buddies on the racetrack and just kind of goof off, you can see how good this thing's potential extends to the street and how all of those qualities, like the good low end torque, the good mid range, and the fact that it just has better hold up throughout the chassis, how these things are going to play out on the road. even if you know you're not matching the same pace that you want on a racetrack. Although that said, some of the areas of Modena, you know, some of the really tight infield section, oh, you'd find that in sections of a Malibu all day long. You know, tight switchbacks are just snapping back and forth. And the thing flips back side to side. I mean, it's just, we said it was agile, but really that descriptor isn't strong enough, we'll say.
Did they mention anything about making me happy with a Tuono 457?
No, but if we know Aprilia logic, probably going to happen. Because, I mean, where the RSV goes, a Tuono always follows. So
I hope so. And I will probably steal that one from you to test. So.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, this thing on the street, I could see it doing real good. But yeah, it's the lightweight segment right now is incredibly strong. We have the KTMs, the Ninja 500, the CF Moto 450 SS, bit of a dark horse. And this thing is coming in.
Oh, there's another one that we kind of haven't mentioned, and you can at least explain why. The Honda CBR 500R.
Ah,
it's funny because that used to be in its own class, but now there's this, you know, because everything was like a 300 or a 400, but now everything is marched up to the 500 range.
That's true. So it did kind of have to wait a number of years to get some playmates. The Honda's a weird bike, right? Because one, it's more expensive than everything here, and it is physically larger too. So if you're a taller rider, that Honda might work out better. But it's also significantly heavier and makes the same power.
Okay. So that's what we were looking to hear.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, it's awesome that you got to ride with Maverick. That's totally cool. And on a cool track with some history in Italy on an Italian motorcycle.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the RS457 had a blast on. And yeah, we're stoked. I'm stoked. You're stoked. Everyone's stoked to try to get some street time on it and see if those positive traits trickle down there.
Well, I think we've covered it pretty thoroughly. And till the next time, I'm Don Williams, editor of Ultimate Motorcycling, and I'm here with Nick DeSena, the senior editor at the same Ultimate Motorcycling magazine.
Yes.
Thanks for listening. Okay. Bye.
In the second segment this week, associate editor TJ Adams chats with Mark Foster, founder and expert roaster of the acclaimed Foster Built Coffee, based in the Catskill Mountains of New York State. Well, what does that have to do with motorcycles, I hear you ask? Well, Mark is also a passionate motorcycle guy, and in this month of April, he's giving away a custom Royal Enfield 350 motorcycle. Yes, true. Please visit the Foster Built Coffee website for details of how to enter to win. But hurry, you only have a few days left to get your entry in.
We like to go for a ride and stop for a coffee, and coffee is very important. So how did you come about making that a business for yourself?
Well, it started also in upstate New York in the Catskills. It's a very rural little town called Bovina, and it was an old cow town, which there are two working milk farms still today working, and I know both those families, and they're amazing people. But it was few and far between coming from New York City to find like a really good cup of coffee, you know, a cappuccino, an espresso, and you know, and I'm an entertainer. I have like people for dinner, for you know, for the weekend and stuff. So I ended up figuring out how to roast coffee and just make my own, and you know, got an espresso machine. And so I just started, you know, it was sort of like a self-sufficiency kind of thing. And I ended up just enjoying the process. I love tinkering and building things. So, you know, an espresso machine and like, you know, dialing in a craft, it worked for me. So, I mean, the short story is I dialed it into the point where my friends wanted to take, you know, bags of it home. And then the store across the street, little general store, wanted to carry it. So I grew it very organically. And I started with, a countertop roaster, and then it went to a barbecue. And then from there, I built this 55 gallon drum that I could do 40 pounds at a time. So, you know, it just kind of evolved into a supplier, really. So and then the motorcycles things, that's just, it's who I am. I do motorcycles, I do hot rods. I have a 1931 Ford here I'm working on.
Beautiful.
Changing from 6-volt to 12-volt, which is the newer system that started in the early mid-50s. So yeah, I love the old way of doing things, you know, the roll up your sleeves. I love teaching my kids how to do things, you know, the old way, and they all know how to roast coffee. They're, you know, everybody's out there. My girlfriend also has a daughter. She's 11. So everybody lends a hand scooping coffee and hauling bags and putting labels on the bags. We do everything manually.
I love the way that skills are being recognized as being important now, crafts. And as you say, the old way of doing things, we went to the Handbuilt Motorcycle Show, and that kind of was all that vibe of people who've just want something, and so they make it themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I came to it a little later. I mean, I was definitely a creative person. My mom was a painter. She was an art teacher. My dad had a pile of bicycles, you know, in the garage, you know, growing up. So there was always things around to tinker on, but I was never like an engine person until later. Now I'm figuring out, like, I don't want to get stranded, so I want to know how to, you know, fend for myself if you know, something breaks down.
And did you start riding quite young then, if you were surrounded by all that sort of gear?
Bicycles, yes. I rode, my mom, we lived in suburbia. I grew up in Long Island, New York. So it wasn't like, you know, wide open fields, which, you know, we would go camping and I would be exposed to it then. And I would see kids with motorcycles and big sighs would happen, you know, as we drove past, but I was never allowed to have one. My mom said, you're not allowed to have one until you're at least 40. Okay. So I actually waited until I was 40.
Oh, how good of you.
Not because of the rule, but it just happened to turn out that way because I was bouncing between California and New York. But yeah, by the time I was 40, I got myself a KTM dirt bike.
So if you don't mind me saying so, that's quite a mature sort of start in life on motorcycles. And so what did you start with?
The first motorcycle, actually, I shouldn't say that. The first one I really got and rode like a bat out of hell was a KTM when I was 40. But when I lived in California, I bought a Honda 554. It was 1976 554, and I was probably like 26 years old. But I didn't ride it though, because again, I still lived in the suburbs. I lived in Venice, and then I lived in San Francisco, and I may have put 20 miles on that motorcycle before selling it. But but then I was off to the races when I turned 40. And, you know, I had the blessing from my mother. I'm kidding. she'll say, that's right. But I just bought this one yesterday. It is a 1972 Triumph with a Bonneville motor in it. And this poor guy was having to empty out an airplane hangar of all his projects. Apparently there was like a land deal that like came up for renewal, and he's had it in his family, for years. And then they basically owned it, but there was like a renewal on the land deal that they had with the airport or the city that came up during COVID, and they didn't see it. So it went back up for auction, and the city well knew that, you know, they were going to sort of get him on that and be able to sell it again. So it was pretty not nice business. So I felt bad for the guy. So, but yeah, I mean, I got that for a great deal. And I'm probably going to turn it into a dirt bike. I love riding in the trees. That's my favorite, type of riding, is just being up in the woods. And yeah, the property that I have up in upstate New York is 46 acres. It's like a little event space that we're curating to let people come and just gather. It's, you know, community based. There's trails, and we have an outdoor kitchen, a pizza oven. So it's a nice place to get people together. It's the Northwestern Catskills. There's a university town about, I think like 10 miles away. It's called Delhi, New York. And the University of Delhi is there, SUNY, New York. And then in the other direction is Andes, New York. But our little town is called Bovina, which stems from the bovine name, because it was a cattle town.
And so is this area, this 46 acres, you're going to make available to the public?
It is. It's, I purchased it with a partner of mine right before I moved to Detroit. So the project kind of went on hold, and you know, we've just been maintaining it. I mean, the first thing we had to do was clean it up. It was in terrible shape. The previous owners had kind of let the barn go, and you know, we just did a lot of cleaning, and he's been doing big 4th of July celebrations there. So people come up and they just spread out on the lawn, and we have a big display. So every summer I'm able to cruise out. But now with my Bollinger Motors project coming to a close, I'm able to actually get out there a little more and work on it, especially now that springtime is here. It's very muddy there right now, but I was just there a couple of days ago.
The plan is people can come up there with their dirt bikes, families and children, and get to ride around.
The main focus is really having a place for people to come and stay, you know, making it like an event space. Like if you wanted to have your wedding there, we're going to have sort of glamping, camping accommodations there. And a hiking trail. It's more set for, we're more going to publicize it being for hiking and bicycle, mountain biking. Because you bring motorcycles. As much as I love motorcycling, I mean, it's my property. I can take care of it. And if I ruin it, I will fix it. But if we have guests there who don't really know the property, I don't want to open it up to that kind of damage or abuse.
So where have you found now is your favorite sort of area to ride? You've covered all sorts of areas of the United States. Where do you enjoy most?
Well, I did a run down in Bandera, Texas. That was really fun last year. And I believe it was right before the Handbuilt show as well. We were there the same weekend and we passed through there. Was that in Austin?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. No, it was that show. That was super fun. And the timing was perfect. So we left Bandera, went down across to Austin and saw that. So we got to see a lot of really amazing builds. Good riding there. It's very dry, deserty, but I like the grippy sort of almost Moab style rocks that we were able to find. There was a place in Texas that we rode, and we took the B1 electric truck prototype as well, and we were sort of the moto entourage around it. I can't remember the name of it, but it was like the something caves. Does that ring a bell? I mean, you're there right now. I don't know if you're.
Not for me, no. I'm not that familiar with sort of.
It was amazing. I mean, and the gentleman running the place, it was a family-run place. I mean, he took us on a tour and just gave us, you know, he gave us the highlights. He said, oh, it'll look amazing on these rocks, and took us up to these, you know, beautiful vistas. And that was great. That was beautiful riding. But before that trip, we were in Joshua Tree. We did the Aether Rally last year. And it's also a Royal Enfield, the 650. It's more of a street bike though. Yeah, but this 350 I put together really for the snow. We host a thing, myself and my buddy Hunter. He runs an organization called Moto Michigan, and we have been, which started in New York, a thing called Winter Moto Camp. And since I moved out here, he and I have sort of partnered up with that. And that bike was designed for winter moto camp, just to get through the snow. And
so people like to go and ride in the snow?
They do. I mean, Michigan certainly has, has its winter wonderland sporting reputation. The last couple of winters haven't been crazy cold though. So any kind of ice riding, which is, I have some buddies who do that as well. And I took my hand at that as well, which is, it's just an incredible feeling. But you have to go so far north right now. I mean, the last couple of winters, there were just not enough days that it deep freezes enough to get out on the ice and ride.
So what do you like about riding on the ice?
I mean, I'm not an experienced ice rider, but I did try it with a friend of mine who does it a lot. And I think the biggest thing to overcome is that feeling like when you're on ice, if you turn, you'll fall. If you turn, you'll slip. But in this case, you actually don't. You have more traction than you would normally have on pavement. You know, pavement, you could actually slide out if it's wet. But those screws in the tires hold you to the ground. And like, you know, I think the attraction is that it's just, it's like, you know, riding on glass. You're just out there on a lake and those tires, they hold. And it's just the most liberating experience once you get over the fact that you're not going to just like, you know, slip out like you're on a banana.
And what do? You just go as fast as possible, or do you?
I mean, they have different courses. They have, you know, straightaways. They have there's a flat tracking community, and my buddy CJ Winnegar, he's a very good flat track racer, and he turned me on to it. He's like, you got to come up to the lake, and you know, so you know, I went up and tried it. But you know, so they'll do like a they'll make like a flat track style course. I mean, flat track is just like an oval, I think, but some of them have, you know, some turns to it, some twisties. But there was one that I went and visited him on, and you know, it had like a serpentine kind of, you know, layout where, yeah, you're doing left turns, right turns, you know, there's a straightaway and a turn. And I mean, it's just like, it's crazy. So you're really, you're trusting your screwed tires.
So these tires have the screws sticking outwards.
They screw them from the inside out, you know, so they go up through the knobs. Some of them actually screw in from the top. I mean, there's different styles, but I mean, hundreds of screws go in these tires. They triple in weight because of the metal. It's like taking 10 boxes of screws and just adding it to the weight of your wheels.
Right. And how does that feel when you're braking?
I mean, again, it's just it's all the same. I mean, you skid the same. You know, you're tearing up the ice, but
right. I'm thinking that it's going to be sort of quite sudden braking. The feedback from or the action of braking is going to be quite.
Yeah, yeah. And they have fenders on these ice bikes that go up and over the wheel all the way down the front. So if you do, you know, run into somebody, you don't saw them in half. Because they are like saw blades.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Wow, you've covered some different types of motorcycling.
For sure. I actually have a fun motorcycle that I bought a couple of years ago, just before winter hit here. And it's from a French trials company that is fully electric, and they're called Electric Motion. And that is by far the funnest motorcycle I own. It's like a trials bike with a proper seat on it. So you know, those bikes are designed to be standing up and you kind of hop. It also has a clutch, which in trials riding, I think you use the spin of the motor to, you know, assist your balance. I'm not a trials rider, but like, I loved how low this bike was to the ground and close to the ground. I'm not a very tall person. So like the closer to the ground, the more, you know, rocky or kooky things I can get over. And again, like, so it feeds into my love for riding in the trees. I mean, I can get over logs and rocks and, you know, through wet things. And, you know, that thing just, it's another very confidence instilling bike. And it's one of the best ones out there as far as that type of riding. I mean, that stuff's coming a long way. But when I bought it, it was definitely the best one available.
And had you ridden like the standard sort of trail bike before trying the electric? How did that compare?
Yeah, I mean, getting back to you asked me what the first bike was. I bought a KTM a KTM 200. It was like a 2002, and that was the first bike I, you know, let loose in the woods with, and two stroke. So it just, you know, has that power band that just lets you go.
So you can do climbing and slow maneuvers. Yeah. That thing.
And again, that bike and, you know, trail bikes in general, they sit so high because they're, you know, they're made to take big impacts. But the kind of riding I really enjoy is like kind of crawling through, you know, I come from a mountain biking and a BMX background. So like, you know, real technical trails where you have to like think about it and kind of, you know, maneuver your way through. I love that kind of riding, up or down, especially with an electric bike. You can just, you know, kind of weasel your way up the steepest stuff that you never would have thought you could get up.
So you find you've got more pull. Does it feel electric is more immediate?
Well, you're not worried about it stalling because you can come to a stop and it's, you know, the power's right there as soon as you need it. So you can just like fudge yourself over a little bit and boom, get, you know, so, which, you know, I'm, you know, the clutching and the style of, you know, a real trials rider, you know, they know how to do that all day long. They can hop and dance like a ballet performer, but, you know, I like a little bit of everything. As you can see, I don't pick any one. I got ants in my pants.
I know you've got a finger in every pie, haven't you? So that's what I'm thinking. What's your favorite? But you seem to, each thing you're talking about, you're extremely enthusiastic about each different discipline.
Yeah, I'm a pro at none of them, but I certainly enjoy them all. And my kids love, my kids love riding their bikes. They have little BMX bikes over here, and their skateboards are here, and our helmet wall over there, you know.
So do they have to wait until they're 40 for a motorcycle?
Well, I'm trying to hold off. I don't know if I'm going to be able to hold off until they're 40, because that would make me like 95, I think. No, I think I'd be over 100.
It's just laughable that there's a magic age when suddenly.
Yeah. Oh, man. No. So funny.
So it seems like Foster Built, which is your coffee roasting and distribution company, mm-hmm. is the thing you're focusing on currently. Tell us a little bit about how you're getting that out there. You're involved with the Royal Enfield Motorcycles.
Well, my only involvement is really I love their bikes. I was actually just talking to a friend before we got on the phone, and we were talking about a trip I did to India. I was a filmmaker. I was a commercial director for 25 years in New York City, which is when I went up and met the Bollinger team. But I was filming something in Mumbai. And then at the end of the project, I took a couple of days to get out of the city. And I took a bus to Goa, which is this little beach community town, vacation spot for a lot of Russian people. I mean, to the point where the signs were in Russian, there was such an inundation. But I was able to rent a motorcycle, and they had Royal Enfields, but they were old, like 60s and 70s. Bikes that just like took a licking and kept on ticking. I loved that, they just repaired them and put them together, sort of like in Cuba, like they just use what they had and keep them going forever. It feels like those are the motorcycles of India. So I was fascinated with them. I was like, oh, how can I ship one of these home? But that went away, but I always kept my eye on them. And then they really, in the last, I don't know, maybe 10-15 years, they got very popular. So I mean, about 4 years ago I bought these bikes, actually no even more recently, 2 years ago. But I wanted a turnkey bike with the styling of my 60s and 70s motorcycles, because I love riding the old stuff, but like I'm not super mechanical. I know my way around it, but I definitely have friends who are way faster at stuff like that for me. But these are turnkey. I call them my Toyotas. They just fire up and go. So I like to ride and not tinker as much as I ride.
They are. I have one myself. I love the brand. I think value for money as well. Their price point. Oh,
they're so approachable. Yeah. But anyway, getting back to my involvement is strictly, I'm a fan. So.
Right.
Yeah. And, cool. And I want it, with the giveaway, with the Fosterville coffee giveaway, giving this bike away, I really want somebody else to have the joy that I had. And of course, I wanted to promote our coffee. I want people to drink our coffee. But, the fun that this thing has given me at such a small cost, like I'd rather give it away in the name of our coffee, lifestyle and culture, and then build another one and do something fun with it.
So this is what I wanted to let people know about. And so under the Foster Built Coffee brand, you're giving away a Royal Enfield.
Yeah, so we're giving away this classic 350 Royal Enfield, which I have modestly modified. I basically just changed the tires. I put lower handlebars on it. I removed the front fender and a rear sort of cargo seat, really just to make it a single person, woods chugger, just to thump through the snow, through the streams, and it's the little engine that could, it's just a fun little gateway bike that like I just had a great time, and I think somebody else will too.
Yeah, it's really
win, I'm gonna keep it.
So how do people how do you go about winning?
We're doing the giveaway. It's sort of a system where it's like you buy, I'm also a graphic designer by trade, with just my commercial background. So I've designed t-shirts, which I had a t-shirt company in New York City, little store called P13, many, many ages ago, but it doesn't exist anymore. But I still have all the technology to make t-shirts. And I love doing it. You could say I'm a little bit of a t-shirt whore. So I made Fosterville t-shirts, some of them a little more lifestyle oriented, you know, just about coffee and the culture, but also just about like motorcycles and old stuff. And so if you buy a tote bag or a sweatshirt or a t-shirt, as many dollars as you spend gives you that many chances to win the motorcycle.
And what is the draw date for the motorcycle to be given away?
It is April 26th or the end of April.
So we'll get a link and put it on in the show notes so that people can hop onto your website and enter.
Absolutely. That would be awesome.
Sounds like you have a fascinating life. You're just dipping in all over the place.
Yeah, it looks good on Instagram.
Well, it seems really exciting to me. I think a lot of people are going to have a few goes at what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, it's fun. I mean, I think I'm definitely a glass half full kind of person. And, whatever I'm involved in, I try and make the best out of everything. So I'd like to just pass that along.
Sounds like you really aim to enjoy yourself.
I do. And everybody around me, you know, it's like there's not enough time on this planet to get caught up in things. So.
And have you met some exciting or interesting people through motorcycling?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I've seen great things. I've done fun things, off-roading. I mean, my last career as a brand director has, you know, brought me all over the place. And I mean, everywhere I go, I meet great people, and, you know, I like to think we gravitate towards each other and encourage each other to do fun stuff.
Well, thanks for chatting with us. I'm going to put that link into the show notes, and I wish you all the best.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, TJ. It was great meeting you, and I hope we gave you some good stuff.
Certainly. Ta-da, then.
All right. Take care. Thanks. Bye-bye.